This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Ted Miklau. I'm the Chief Orthopedics here at San Francisco General, and I'm the Director of the Orthopedic Trauma Institute. This is the end of our second mini medical school series that we had. And the first one we gave, we thought we had done a good job, and they asked us to come back again. And so at the end of the second one, hopefully we can get some comments from you all at the end of the lecture today to find out whether or not there are other topics that we ought to be covering or things you might be interested in hearing about. We committed to UCSF to do this on an annual basis, so we'll try and do this. This particular session was also by request. How many of you have been on the San Francisco General Hospital campus before? Show of hands. So probably half. How many live in the city? Almost most people do. Okay. So this is your trauma center. And we've been here, San Francisco General Hospital has been here since the mid-1800s. I've got a little bit of the history. This building is 100 years old. So what we're going to do today is give you a brief overview of the Orthopedic Trauma Institute. And what I'd like to emphasize in this talk is that the word institute or center of excellence, those are way overused because often they're just clinical, just provision of clinical care in a place which is really important. But what we want to do here is be the place where learning happens, discoveries are made, and brought to the patient's bedside. That's what an institute is. It really moves the field forward. And there are many places like this on this campus. So I always love giving talks to people who are new to San Francisco General Hospital on the campus, because many people don't recognize what we do here. You know, it's often been viewed, I've been here for 20 years, it's often been viewed as a place of last resort, you go to when you're hurt, homeless people come here, if there's a gunshot, you know, those people get brought here. It's not necessarily for everybody, but actually it is. It's for anybody that gets hurt in the city can come here. The main issue is that right now, the only time you can come here is if you are brought in by an ambulance or have insurance, or if you have government insurance like Medicare, Medi-Cal, Healthy San Francisco, those sorts of programs. One of the things that we've had to design with our institute is, and I'll show you the different places that we go, because trauma services are really highly valued around the Bay Area, everywhere, but certainly including the Bay Area, which has about 6 million people. We've been asked to actually do coverage outside of San Francisco General Hospital. And so this is only one of several hubs where we treat patients. So if you did get injured and you did want us to be your doctors, we could actually see you at different places. But most of the services here can't. I'd say there's some services that actually provide their care at UCSF. And here, but for the most part, there aren't many services that go to all the different places that we do. So this is kind of a fun, interesting economic model, financial model, too, for establishing a medical practice. So as I mentioned, this is your trauma center. There are about 1.5 million people in San Francisco at any one time. If you get hurt from anywhere on from the bridges down to mid-San Mateo, this is where you're coming for your care. There are a variety of level trauma centers around the Bay Area, and what you can see here is that the triangles are the ones that are level one centers. Level one centers are those centers that are academic medical centers where you do research, you have trainees. Level two centers are those centers that are here in the circles. And those centers, like San Jose Regional Medical Center, those centers provide the same kind of care level one centers do, but don't really have the training and the education. And these centers are all certified by the American College of Surgeons. And then there's level three centers, which are sort of initial management and transfer, and level four centers, you genuflect and hope that you can make it to the next place because they send you out. So you can see here that within the Bay Area that there's only really one trauma center. We also cover Regional Medical Center of San Jose. The next speaker is going to be talking about education, Amir Matidiahu. He's the medical director of that center. And then we have a clinic over in Sutter at St. Mary's, St. Luke's Hospital. And we also see patients at UCSF. Dr. Morshed, who will be speaking to you about clinical research, is the trauma director over at the University of California, San Francisco. So we're the trauma doctors for a lot of places. This is an interesting building that you'll see. So as I mentioned, the San Francisco General Hospital campus was founded in 1849. And about that time, it also had one of the first indigent care contracts in the country, which is pretty visionary. It was one of the first emergency medical systems, and originally it was horse and buggy. That's Potrero Avenue. It was one of the first teaching institutions, and it was arguably the first trauma center in the country. There's an argument between here and shock trauma in Maryland as to who was first, but for sure, we are one of the pioneers in trauma care, and I'll get to that in a second, how it's important for orthopedic trauma. And the Orthopedic Trauma Association was founded here, and I'll mention that in a little bit, too. So trauma growth happened in part here because of the unrest that happened at the end of the 60s, early 70s with the Vietnam War and the protests. And you can see that the general surgery cases had increased almost fivefold, and the trauma surgery had increased like over threefold. And the way that they were dealing with things were, number one, to try to set up a pre- to post-hospital care system so the patients would be cared for throughout the continuum. They also designed a system where general surgeons and anesthesiologists, the people who had to be in the hospital for this absolute emergency care, were present in-house. And so this started where doctors were spending, faculty were spending the time in-house. And then the final thing that happened, which was relevant to our specialty, was that the general orthopedics, the first chief of this during this time was somebody who was an oncology doctor who operated all over the body. They became more and more interested in becoming expert in trauma care. And so that's how trauma sort of became more of a specialty within different specialties, including orthopedic surgery. The Orthopedic Trauma Association is now the largest international body in the that deals with academic medicine in orthopedic trauma. And it was founded in this little Vietnamese restaurant across the street. Now has a for lease sign because unfortunately they went out of business. But the chair at the time, Edwin Bovell, met with one of the leaders down from Southern California and one of his younger faculty, Mike Chapman, who later went on to start the first trauma fellowship in the country. And fellowship is training after residency. And they started this Orthopedic Trauma Center Study Group, which became the Orthopedic Trauma Hospital Association, which later became the Orthopedic Trauma Association. And that was in the mid-80s. For us, what happened was between the mid-80s and sort of early 2000s, we were very much a community hospital that did trauma. And in 2000, we had a large exodus of our faculty, and we had to reinvent ourselves. And we started by becoming a trauma center that was also good at everything else that we needed to provide community medicine for. So we'll get to the specialists. And it really flipped the paradigm on its head. And 2 years ago, we worked to develop our mission statement. And this particular mission statement, I think, encapsulates kind of what we do to mend the injured, inspire innovators, and empower leaders to restore lives. So we like to, we care for people. We want to develop the innovations that enhance our practices, and we want to empower leaders across the world to be able to be teachers of the the latest and greatest in our specialty. So for the Orthopedic Trauma Institute, this particular floor and what you'll see on the tour, it was founded in 2009. This building has been everything from an isolation unit for TB and smallpox to a nursing ward to an inpatient ward, and most recently was workers' compensation floor before we took it over, and we pretty much inherited a lot of the space because nobody else wanted it. And so through our own labor, we managed to renovate. So all these renovations you see here were basically created by doctors, and we did it several ways. One way was to apply for grant money. Another way was to use creative negotiations. So we would say, okay, Mr. Stryker Company, we're going to go ahead and use all your equipment and bring people from all over the place to see it, and they'll not have any other place where they can do that. And then the final thing was we were able to sort of write grants and use some of our own money, so the doctors would save money every year and put it aside and then just reinvest instead of taking it home. We wanted to invest in our home. And so if you really talk to a lot of faculty, this is kind of home for us. This is a home away from home. So we have a variety of things that we are our pillars. One is clinical, one is education, one is research, and the other is outreach. And we'll talk about each of these, but I'm going to gloss over the education, the research piece, because we're going to have Dr. Matityahu talk about education. He's going to focus on a couple of programs as well. And we're going to have Dr. Marcuccio talk about our basic research, and Dr. Morshin talk about our clinical research. And each of them are going to give about a 10-minute talk. So these are our four pillars. As I mentioned, as far as patient care, we have 13 orthopedic-trained faculty. We started with two in 2002, and we've added one or two every year. And orthopedic trauma fellowships are kind of the gold standard now for people doing orthopedic trauma care. So just because you're an orthopedic surgeon doesn't mean you're able to take care of the most complicated fractures and injuries, or a constellation of those. And that's what the Orthopedic Trauma Fellowship does. And so we have right now 12 orthopedic trauma-trained surgeons in our group, and it's the largest group in the country for that. We also have a full line of musculoskeletal medicine. So we do podiatry, which is more foot, forefoot surgery, physiatry, which is rehabilitation, and we have four full-time faculty research in the major areas, and I'll mention what those are in a second here. We do have fellows, so we train people to become higher level surgeons in trauma, and we have a very large group of residents. So like UCSF, we train the rest of the departments in UCSF. San Francisco General Hospital trains about a third of the residents, does a third of the research. UCSF is ranked number one in the country, according to the last figures that came out, in all of its institutions in NIH funding. Our department is ranked number two in NIH funding, and our service just here in these walls provide about 30 to 40% of that overall funding. If we are our own department here, ranked against all others in the country, we'd be ranked number 16th in the country. So there's really a lot of work that goes on here that is way above and beyond just being a community hospital. That should be the take-home message here. So this is our full-time faculty. All of the italicized areas are fellowship-trained surgeons who have done a fellowship in those areas. And what's interesting for our model is that we've really started to require all of our surgeons to do a trauma fellowship and one other fellowship in something else. And there's seven specialties in orthopedics. In addition to trauma, there's foot and ankle, there's hand, there's sports, there's spine, there's oncology, there's pediatrics, and there's sports, so I guess eight. So our faculty are good at doing that and doing trauma, which makes us sort of unique in the country. We have these clinical sites that I'd mentioned to you, St. Luke's and Davies Hospital, through the Sutter system. We see patients at the Orthopedic Institute over at Mission Bay and at Parnassus campuses, and we're also at Regional Hospital of San Jose, which is an HCA hospital. We do not have a helipad, so this is one of the top 25 cities in the country, the only one that doesn't have air medical access, which is problematic if you consider that we're on a peninsula surrounded by water and bridges and potentially in an earthquake-prone area. There has been a lot of San Francisco Avenue, you know, is very political, and the neighbors are not very happy about a helipad, so we haven't had air medical access here. But certainly that's something that we would all benefit from, in my opinion. So we have a lot of educational conferences here. We have, like I said, we have a third of the residents in every stage. We have fellows. We have international visitors from all over the world. At any one time, we have two or three visitors that are here from different places. And I'll show you all the places that they come from at the end. I'm not going to talk any more about education. I think Dr. Matiao is going to talk about Surgical Training Center. I will say that it's getting ready for its 10th anniversary. We've trained over 10,000 healthcare providers worldwide. We have a trauma course that is the largest of its kind in this country. It's about a month away. We get over 500 attendees from 40 to 50 states in, on average, and over 15 countries. Research, I'd mentioned that they're going to speak about this, but specifically in orthopedics, because it's a it deals with structural bones and joints, biomechanics is really important as well. We won't be touching too much on that today, but biomechanics, molecular biology, clinical research, and then research studying surgical technique. We can do all of that here in these walls, and we'll, when we on our tour, we can show you the facilities of this. I'm not going to talk too much about Laboratory for Skeletal Regeneration, albeit to say that we have three full-time PhDs who are in the lab. Dr. Marcuccio is the lead of that, and we're one of the. He's typically the last 5 years he's been in the top five people in the country with NIH funding studying. Two different areas, musculoskeletal injury and repair, and craniofacial development. And he'll explain the similarities between the two fields. Our biomechanical testing facility, we have collaborations all over the country. And our clinical research center, some we'll talk a little bit about. But we're one of the main centers for a lot of the research that goes on across the country in trauma care. I'll end with our outreach. This is one of the things we're proudest of. And we started out by doing a lot of sort of mission work, which was very popular in the 90s and 80s and before. Dr. Richard Coughlin is seen over here. He was receiving the Humanitarian of the Year Award. We've had two of our faculty receive that in the 6 years that it's been awarded. We do some mission work. We do some local community work. You can see the middle picture there. There's one little blonde boy that happens to be my kid. That group of kids went on 3 years later to win the state championship, and we had funding. And then we do a lot of, and maybe Amir will talk about this too, some international education. And if he doesn't, I'll just mention it now, where we have surgeons come from all over the world to train here to learn how to do soft tissue flaps. We do this in conjunction with them learning how to fix bones, and then they go back to their country and they're able to actually take their trade to their other trainees and their patients. And in one course, they surveyed those doctors that came. There were about 50 doctors from about 30 different countries, and they had treated 600 patients. When the Nepal earthquake hit, 11 of the Nepalese surgeons had trained here at some point. So we also have started to do these same courses now in countries. So we've done them in Tanzania. We've done them in Nepal. We're going to try to do it in Mexico next year as well. So it is all through this institute, which is really a fabulous thing. It's the Institute for Global Orthopedics and Traumatology, and it's really the only one of its kind in orthopedics in the country right now. And the idea is that we wanted to develop sustainable healthcare research and education to lower and middle income country partners, so people who could actually sustain it beyond us just having to be there the whole time. There are a variety of things that we do locally, regionally. For IGOT, I encourage you to go to our IGOT website, which is igotglobal.org, and you can learn a little bit more about that. If you want to donate, you're welcome to donate. This map here shows all the places since we opened in 2009 that we've either been to or had surgeons come from. And there are a few more. This is since 6 months ago. We have a few more countries to color in. But it really shows the ability for us to be able to go out and have a more global reach. For those of you who want to learn a little bit more about this afterwards, we have some videos. So you can go look at the Orthopedic Trauma Institute channel on YouTube. There's an I Got channel as well on YouTube and Vimeo, and then we have some fundraising things. We have also, we're trying to do things within our scale. Everything here has to be run like its own business. We can't run these programs based on the money that we make as doctors, because there's not even enough income from that to actually fully support the staff salaries. So everything that you'll see, the courses, the research, that all has to be done by grant money or contributions, and it have to run on its own programs. And so social media is an easy way for us to get the message out inexpensively. So at this point, I will defer questions. Thank you very much. And I'll have Amir come up, and he's going to talk for about 10 minutes about some of the educational programs that we have here. So really, thank you very much for coming. It's great to see so many people here, and I appreciate your attention.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. I have the pleasure of speaking to you. I think it's an honor, actually, to be in front of you guys and kind of telling you what we're doing. My talk can't cover everything that we do from the educational standpoint. We just have too many things going on here. But what I want to do is I'm going to focus on just a couple things. I'll give you an overview first. I'll focus on a couple things, show you a couple videos, keep you awake, and then end on a good note. I am the one of the orthopedic trauma surgeons here, and I have the privilege of also working in an outreach site for us. It's Regional Medical San Jose, where I'm the chief down there and help run that business. So this is my outline. I'm going to be speaking essentially on the varied educational processes that we have here and the kind of people that we affect in orthopedic trauma. And this varies from high school students to fellows, to international attending surgeons, to local surgeons. I can't focus on everything, as I said, so I'll kind of give you a couple of specific things that we do here that are unique. And what we have, these are the kind of programs that we have here. We have high school students that come in the summer and have an 8-week course, which I'll talk about a little bit. We have a surgical training facility that's one floor up from here that you'll see during the time when you're having a walk around the place, and I'll talk a little bit about that. We also teach medical students. We have a very robust residency program that's really in the top 10 in the country for training orthopedic surgeons, and I'll talk a little bit about the unique way that we teach them here in this facility that is really set apart from almost every other residency program in the country. There's very few that do what we're doing here, and I'll tell you why that is and how we got to it. Dr. McLeod, who was just here, also spoke about the fact that we have daily didactic sessions. We have surgical teaching in the operating room. These residents also have international rotations, as he said, so they go kind of all over the world to learn during their fourth year residency. We do anatomic dissections. Those things you can find in other programs, but the surgical core curriculum, something where they actually get their hands on cadavers to do actual procedures, I'll talk about a little bit more in detail, which is really unique to these residents. We also have a trauma fellowship. The trauma fellowship here has two trauma fellows. These are people who've already graduated from orthopedic residency, and they seek extra training in orthopedic trauma. And we have two of those here. We also have the San Francisco trauma course, which Dr. Mikolov talked about a little bit. We do a lot of international teaching. We have several courses in Tanzania, Nepal, Kenya, and other places around the world where we actually go and we do teaching locally. Okay. So I'm going to start out a little bit with the OTI Junior Academy. So the Orthopedic Trauma Institute, where we are right now, has outreach that essentially spans almost all age groups from high school up. And this is one of those. This is the OTI Junior Academy, which reaches out to high school students. It's a one-of-a-kind program, really, in the country. There's a similar program down in the at Stanford, but it's not nearly what this program is. And what we do essentially is we have students in high school who are in underserved areas. So, for instance, I have two kids. My kids get exposure to medicine all the time, right? They have a doctor who's their daddy, and I talk to them about what's happening at work, et cetera. They get exposure. A lot of these students have no idea what it's like to walk into a hospital and to be on the other side, either as an x-ray tech or a nurse or a physician or other things in medicine. So the idea here basically is that these students get exposure to what medicine is about from the other side, and they actually see a door that opens for them for them to have the ability to walk into the medical field, okay, which most of them don't have before they come here. So the way this works basically is that we have them do job shadowing. So they'll follow me or one of the other doctors or a physical therapist or an x-ray tech or a nurse, etc. They get hands-on experience in surgical training facilities. So they go upstairs where you guys are going to be, and they actually get to work with training physicians. So cadaver work and, you know, hands-on type work. Professional development. So a lot of them, believe it or not, don't know to walk up to you and shake your hand, look you in the eye, and say, "Hi, my name is..." Right? They don't have that experience. They don't understand how to put together a resume. They don't know how to write a little bio sketch of themselves. So all these things are things that we focus on for them to be able to kind of get out of that kind of environment where they don't get this kind of exposure. They also get biomedical engineering exposure. That's part of medicine. We have a very, very robust bioengineering group here. So this is something to get exposure to. Obviously, anatomy. We also teach them about journal club. So most of these students, most high school students, have never read an article critically. So when they read an article from a scientific paper, usually they just take it at face value. What we teach them how to do is actually try and dissect that out and figure out what's really going on in there. The other one is case studies. So case studies are, imagine that you get an x-ray and a history. And then you have to go and search what to do with this patient. What is that diagnosis? All those things that, you know, make you kind of be a detective in medicine. And this is something that just opens their eyes to all the different possibilities of taking patients. One of the things you don't see there is that the aftermath from this is I think 95% of the students have gone to college. So the effect is not just exposure to medicine, but the effect is also the ability of these students to see that there's other things they can do in their life. They're not stuck in some room without a door that can open for them. Of course, these are selected, you know, these are selected for interest. So we're not going to have people here that are coming that are not, you know, interested, because we're basically wasting our time. But that's kind of the program that we have here. So let's talk about the surgical training facility. So again, this is a unique thing that we have here. There are other surgical training facilities around the country, but on the West Coast, if we draw a line down the middle here, what you see essentially is that there are one in Nevada, one in Arizona, and then ours here, okay? And this is with access to residency program, meaning a residency program that has access to a surgical training facility and not just anatomy lab. Anatomy lab means that there's some, you know, specimens there. You just walk down, you do some dissection, and that's it. Here, this is an actual simulation lab where they can try procedures in a safe way before they go to the operating room and do something there. So we have essentially six hands-on stations and three conference rooms. You're sitting in one of them. And this is a fully integrated audiovisual lab, and I'll show you what I mean in a second. This opened in 2007. We train about 1,000 surgeons per year. So this is not just residents, but this is actually attending surgeons from other locations that are coming here to do labs to learn how to do things. Surgical skills training, technique-based research, these are things that are happening in this lab. Three national associations have been here and did their courses here as well. There's more than 100 resident courses, greater than 100 youth community outreach events. I don't know what that six is doing there. And five services here in the hospital utilize this lab. Okay, so it's an integrated lab that gives people the ability to actually work there. And again, I'm going to do a little video just because I think it kind of shows you what the lab looks like. The music is a little bit dramatic, but you'll see how this works in a second. You can turn it down a little bit, maybe. Let me turn it down a little bit. Okay, so we are at San Francisco General Hospital right now. This is the outside of the lab. We give people lead. You're sitting in this room right now where people can use. We have lockers for people to go into, and that's what the lab looks like inside. And what you're seeing there is basically the ability of doctors to do procedures in this lab after learning how to do it from a lab leader. Pretty unique environment. So, and these are guys actually coming from China, believe it or not, to do this lab. Okay. I'm going to stop there because it's a little bit loud. Sorry about that. But you're getting the idea. The idea is that the lab essentially has places where people can learn hands-on, which is unusual. Usually what happens is people are learning from videos or from a lecture like this, etc., right? This is a hands-on thing that they can do. And this learning facility essentially has all these things integrated. So there's, you know, the surgical training facility is integrated with operating room, with an auditorium, with a simulation center, with a web, and with conference rooms. So we can do this in a, for instance, right now we could show you what's happening in that room up there right here. Okay, and this could be projected out to the web if we wanted to do training remotely. So it's fully integrated. That's where it's located. So right now we're on the second floor. So we are right over here, and the lab is right above us, right up there. Okay, so it's you know, right above you. Okay. Now, what I want to talk, I'm going to jump into residency training because I think residency training is one of the ways we utilize the lab that's pretty unique. And this is, again, something you don't see in a lot of other places in the country. As a matter of fact, what we're doing here is unique to us. You know that we're doing daily didactic lectures, so residents get training here. And residents are basically people who had finished medical school and are doing training in orthopedic surgery, right? So they're getting their basic orthopedic surgical training. We have international rotations for them, which Dr. McLeod talked about, on anatomic dissection, and then the surgical core curriculum. So every day we have lectures for them. This is Monday through Friday. I don't want to go into too much. This is pretty standard. You walk into this room, one of the residents comes up, discusses cases, talks about you know, what the indication for surgery may be or may not be, etc. And then the faculty are sitting here and teaching. Okay, very, very common. This happens in almost every residency program in the country. Okay, let's talk about the surgical core curriculum. So the surgical co-curriculum is a little unique, and the reason why we did it is because we realized that traditional orthopedic trauma education may not be enough for residents. And the reason why that is because of work, something called work hour restriction. And you may have heard of this before, that residents are restricted to the number of hours they're allowed to work, which is good for them so they can be awake and alert and oriented, right? They're not confused and asleep and making mistakes. On the other hand, it decreases the amount of exposure that they have to surgical cases, okay? And it decreases the amount of time that they have to learn from faculty, okay? So we know that the ACGME mandates hands-on training, assessment, and, you know, we can't manage what we can't measure, which means that we need to be able to measure what we're teaching them to know that when they're done and they graduate, they're able to do what they're supposed to do. So what we've done basically is created the surgical core curriculum, which is what we think residency programs need in general. And this was developed here in this place because we have the access to the surgical training facility. And what we've done is created a hands-on cadaveric-based teaching. And really what we want is we want cases that they need to be able to know how to do when they're done and when they graduate. And we want them to do it twice. Okay, so that's why you see that, you know, we're using cadaveric specimens, we're using implants and instruments for surgery that they actually use in the operating room, and there's teachers, and we need some funding to do this. So we have 18 hands-on sessions. So imagine 18 hands-on sessions over a two-year period, so a little bit less than monthly, essentially. We cover topics of the major importance to each orthopedic subspecialty, so they'll learn how to do arthroplasty, how to do knee arthroscopy, shoulder arthroscopy, you know, those kind of things, fixed fractures. There are six stations, and basically it's 5-to-1, so five residents with one attending. So what happens is that, you know, their level of learning from their first year through their fifth year changes. So each lab for them is applicable to their level of training. And I'll show you what that means in a second as well. So hopefully you can see that. We need to be able to evaluate this lab. Again, there's not one program that I know of that's doing these kind of things. And what we do is we give them a pretest. So they show up, they get a pretest. Then they have an in-lab competency assessment. Then they have a post-test. Okay, so they come in the lab. They're, you know, telling us, here's what I know. Then we do a lab. We assess them. And then they take a test afterwards, see what they've actually learned. Then we take this and essentially feed it back into the program by evaluating how we're doing. Because we need to evaluate how good of teachers we are, because we want them to, when they graduate, do a good job as attending surgeons. Okay, so the just a little bit more detail. What we do basically is give them some questions, then we give them a lecture, then we do a lab, then we do another test, and then we review all these things, and we're trying to figure out if we're doing a good job. They're learning practical surgical anatomy, look at the top stuff, procedural-based learning, access to videos created during the sessions. They get basically graduated learning depending on their level, and then they get a self-assessment of clinical and technical skills in a safe environment. So if you take this thing and you put it in the operating room, it's high stress, not that safe, right? They can't make a mistake, right? In the operating room, we should not be making mistakes. So this is a good, safe way to do it. For the faculty, basically, it really helps in their teaching skills. So if I'm a faculty and I'm teaching a resident in a cadaver, which is safe, I'm able to teach them in ways and expand my teaching ability. It also gives me a protected time for hands-on instructions with them. So I can be with them taking my time instead of in the operating room where, let's go, we got to finish this case. You know, you can't just not move forward. And then we also get feedback from them. How am I doing as a teacher to teach you? Right, so that 360 type of evaluation is really important. We also have funders, and they really get an opportunity for recognition. So, you know, when somebody funds this kind of program, which is not cheap, what we try and do is give them recognition that, you know, they're helping us, and we really appreciate it. Okay, so how do you evaluate a program like this? What you do is you have outputs, outcomes, and impact. And this is something that really affects the surgical skill sessions, program management, partnerships, and administrators. And basically the outputs are hands-on comprehensive surgical curriculum, dynamic evaluation tools, and video archives. The outcomes are significant improvement from pre to post-test, so we want to make sure we're doing a good job teaching them. We want to report compliance to make sure that we're doing things correctly. Okay, this is what the lab looks like. These are some of the residents who have gone through this. And because I have limited time, I can't like talk about every little thing that we're doing with this lab. But what you see essentially here is different levels of surgical residents all in the same lab learning different things. And they're really happy. You can see that down there. Okay. Lastly, I just want to touch again really quickly on something that we do that's pretty unique as well, which is our fourth-year residents get an international rotation to go and learn somewhere else. You should know that orthopedic trauma occurs, and you're going to get a lecture about this at the end, but orthopedic trauma occurs 90% of the time outside the developed world. Okay? So 90% of the time it's occurring outside the developed world, and 1% of orthopedic surgeons are in the developing world. Okay? So in San Francisco, you have something like 200 orthopedic surgeons. Okay? In Kenya, where there's 38 million people, there's 38 or 40 orthopedic surgeons. Just think about that disparity. Okay. So what we're doing is we're sending our residents into those locations so they can learn what it's like to be in a resource-poor environment. You know, so it's a pretty unique educational opportunity. I don't want to talk too much about it because I think somebody else is going to talk about that. Okay. So residency education, I think we need to continually innovate our teaching because time is short. Resources are decreasing, and the integration of surgical training facility is really important for us as we move forward. We do have the annual course that Dr. Mikla talked about, so I won't go there anymore. And if there's any questions, we'll take them at the end. Thank you very much for your attention.
All right. We're educated on education. So Next is Dr. Marcuccio, and he's the he's a professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery, and he's the director of the molecular biology lab, the Laboratory for Skeletal Regeneration upstairs. He's going to talk a little bit about some of the basic research that we do, and I know that there was a session that Dr. Bainey had spoken to you about earlier on in the sessions, and so he's going to sort of incorporate that into to an overview of what we do here.
I'm going to set my timer to bark at 10 minutes. Okay. So, welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming and showing an interest in our work. I wanted to talk to you about the research that we do at the Orthopedic Trauma Institute. As Ted said, I'm the director. But I certainly don't do this alone. And I think the most important thing to show you is the number of people that are involved in the research in our laboratory. So we get funding from the National Institutes of Health. The grants are shown over here. We also have some money from CIRMS, the California Institute of Regeneration Medicine. Most of this money goes to pay the salary of all of these people who work in the lab. So there's four PIs in the lab, shown here in red. Diane is our lab manager. She helped me set the lab up when we set the lab up back in 2003. Marta is a postdoctoral fellow, so she has a PhD, and she's doing further training in our laboratory. These four individuals are graduate students at UCSF. And then we also hire a number of people who are just out of their undergraduate degree, so people from Stanford and people from UC Berkeley who are sort of in transition. They're not sure what they're going to be doing with the rest of their life. They work in our lab for a while to sort of figure things out and then move on to medical school or go to get a PhD. We collaborate with other investigators at San Francisco General Hospital, for instance, Jackie Bresnahan. We collaborate with people at the Veterans Affairs Hospital. We have international collaborations with a woman in Paris, an individual in Calgary. We also have national and a woman in Toronto, and then we work with people at Stanford as well as UMass Lowell. So the point is that we're located at San Francisco General Hospital, but we're working with people across the country and across the world to address different aspects of the questions that we're asking. So the goals of our lab are to understand the regulation of both bone formation and bone regeneration in order to develop therapies to treat both structural birth defects as well as skeletal injuries. So here are our focus areas. I was trained as a developmental biologist, specifically studying how the skull develops. I worked with Ted before this was a trauma institute as a postdoctoral fellow. I got really interested in the research in bone traumatic injuries, and that's why I came to join Ted when he set this place up to run the lab. And so I do my craniofacial research, and I also have developed a trauma research program since I've been on the faculty at UCSF. So I'm going to show you an example of some of the birth defects research that we do because I think it's a little bit unusual. And then I'll talk a little bit about the work that we do with traumatic injuries, and I'll show you this tissue engineering strategy, which I think Chelsea Bainey talked to you about earlier, so I'll be very, very brief about that. And then I'll sort of come back at the end and talk to you about other things that we're doing in the lab. So the disease that we study is called holoprosencephaly. These are individuals with the disease. It's a mutation in a gene called Sonic Hedgehog, or other genes that interact with Sonic Hedgehog can cause this disease. And what I think you can see in its most severe form is true cyclopia. So there's a single median eye located beneath the nose, and the rest of the face is okay. This is a lethal condition. But these individuals survive, and these individuals have close-set eyes. They have mid-facial hypoplasia, so their face doesn't grow forward. These individuals down here have a single central upper incisor tooth. And this woman is a carrier of a mutation in Sonic Hedgehog that can produce the range of phenotypes that you see here. This is a common birth defect. This is probably one of the most common birth defects. It occurs in 1 in 250 pregnancies, about 1 in 16,000 live births. Obviously, this is the cause of most spontaneous abortions in humans. So our interest is really in the question of how does this individual appear completely morphometrically normal, but can give rise to all of these different outcomes during pregnancy. So our idea is that there is some normal variation in facial shape, width of the face, for example, and that disease phenotypes fall on these extremes of this normal distribution. So those individuals with more severe forms of holoprosencephaly would fall farther to the left on this distribution. There are also other mutations which cause the opposite phenotype, so a widening of the face, and bifurcation of the nose, for example, and those people we believe would fall out here. At least this is our hypothesis. So we want to test this hypothesis. And we do this in chick embryos. So chick embryos are incredibly inexpensive. We can get a dozen of them for about $3. They come from Petaluma. Petaluma at one time was the chicken egg capital of the world in the 30s and 40s. And they still produce high-quality fertilized eggs that we use in research. And this is what chick embryos look like at days 3, 4, and 5 of incubation. So this is the face that we're looking at. These are the two nostrils here. These are the eyeballs that are forming. This is the opening of the mouth. This is the lower jaw. You can see a day later, the tissue has just grown. It looks more mature. So here are the nose, the two nasal pits right here, the nostrils, the jaws, the upper jaw is forming here, the lower jaw. And then by day 5, you can see it's starting to look like a pretty decent-looking face with an opening of the mouth right there. And so what we can do is cut a hole in the shell. We can do some manipulation on the embryo. We can put a piece of tape on the shell, and then we can put it back in the incubator and let it develop for a certain period of time, and then we can analyze the results of our experiment. And so what we did to test the hypothesis regarding how a single gene mutation could give rise to that range of phenotypes is that we used a drug that could block the gene activity of sonic hedgehog. This is the causative gene in that disease that I showed you. And what we did is a dose response experiment. So we gave a very high dose of the drug, then we gave half the dose, and then half of that dose, and half of that dose. So it's a doubling dilution. We just cut the dose in half at each step of the way. And in my lab, we can measure shape. So we can actually assign a value, a numerical value for the shape of something using some statistical methods that we have in the lab. And so we can assign a shape score for these individuals, and so that's just plotted here. And this allows us to do things like plot data on a graph of shape data, which normally wouldn't be quantitative. It would be more qualitative. But we can actually plot this data and look for relationships in the data set. So this is just one example of that. I'm trying to talk fast. And so here at the high dose, you can see these individuals are very narrow. This is a wireframe diagram of what the shape of the face looks like. So they're very narrow. And you can see at this next dose, they're a little bit more toward normal. And then very quickly at these doses, you can see that the phenotype really quickly rises to what a normal embryo looks like. And so what this tells us is that for very, very small changes in the activity of that gene product, you can get huge changes in the phenotype, the shape of the embryonic face. And so what we think happens, we think this is a fundamental process that occurs within embryonic tissues, that for very small changes in the activity of a gene, you can generate huge amounts of phenotypic variation in the outcome. And we think that may be responsible for why you get that huge range of phenotypes in these individuals. Okay. So now I want to change topics and talk to you about our trauma work. So we create tibial fractures in mice. Mice are, really the workhorse animals in our laboratory. We can do genetic studies with them. There's a lot of tools for us to study. And our goal here is to understand the mechanism by which animals heal. And so what we do, we anesthetize the mouse very deeply. We place the tibia across these two pins here. We set this piston on the tibia. And then we raise this weight, very scientifically, we raise this weight and drop it onto the spring-loaded platform to break the tibia by three-point bending. We're trying to mimic what happens in an automobile accident. So we're trying to break the bone, we're trying to injure the muscle, and we're trying to injure the blood supply as well. These are all common things that happen to people when they're in an accident. The mice are then on opiates for the duration of the experiment. We don't think they feel a lot of pain. They get up, we can put them back in the cage, and they'll walk around. As soon as they wake up from the anesthesia, they're ambulating and walking around in the cage. We observe them for signs of pain, and we don't really see any. So when fractures heal, these are now histological sections. So these have been embedded in paraffin wax and sectioned really thinly and then stained with a histological stain. This particular stain stains cartilage red and stains bone blue. So you can see here's the bone. Here's the fracture site, and there's this huge amount of cartilage that forms at the fracture site. And then this cartilage is replaced by bone through a process called endochondral ossification. And then the bone is completely replaced, the cartilage, at this late time point, and this is when the bone is completely healed. And so what we want to know, can we recapitulate this process to generate therapies to treat patients?
And I want to just take a step back and talk to you about biomimicry and how this works. So there's a really cool story. These guys invented these really high-speed trains in Japan in the 90s. And these trains would go through the tunnels in Japan, and they would build up a huge cushion of air. They'd push this air through the tunnel. And then when they exited the tunnel, there'd be a huge sonic boom as the trains went from one media to a different media. And so this is a big problem in Japan because it was waking people up as these trains would speed through these tunnels at night. And so one of the engineers was a birder, and he was noticing, this is the kingfisher, it's going full speed straight down into water, and there's no splash whatsoever. And the shape of this beak, the shape of this head here, actually was an inspiration for this engineer to design the bullet train with a very similar shape. And so this allowed the train to speed through the tunnel, not build up that air cushion, and exit the tunnel without making a sonic boom. So that's pretty cool, right? And so that's how you can see how that works from a pure engineering perspective. What we want to do is take biological mechanisms and use those mechanisms to inform us for our engineering technology, for our tissue engineering approaches. So this is a fertilized egg, and this egg has all the information in it to generate an adult animal and to generate all this variation that we see in nature. And so we think that by trying to understand these processes that generate these individual animals, we can actually understand, we can generate ideas to make that bullet train in a biological system to treat a patient. So this is what Chelsea, I think, might have talked to you about. There's a huge unmet clinical need in orthopedic surgery, and what do you do to fill a large defect like that in a patient? Currently, what they do is they take a piece of your hip bone, they take it out, they morselize it, and they pack it in here, and it heals pretty well, depending on the number of stem cells that are present in that hip bone. The problem is that you have donor site pain for almost your entire life. So where they remove that piece of hip bone, you have pain for quite a long period of time. And so our idea is to try to generate a therapy to circumvent that pain. So the stem cell-based therapies that people are trying to use are to generate stem cells, differentiate them in osteoblasts, and have them make a bone matrix, transplant that bone to heal the bone. The problem is that bone doesn't survive very well because the bone has a high requirement for blood supply. And so you have to generate this composite tissue, transplant the composite tissue in. The vasculature has to anastomose with the host vasculature. So it's a really complicated process. So we thought, well, bones heal by making cartilage. Cartilage is a completely avascular tissue. Cartilage actually induces its own vascularization, so it attracts blood vessels to invade the cartilage, and then the cartilage turns into bone. So we thought, why not take stem cells, differentiate them into cartilage, then transplant the cartilage into the bone and try to heal the bone defect that way? And so that's exactly what we did. So we made a defect in the mouse tibia, we got some cartilage, and we transplanted it into this defect, and then 28 days later, you can see this is the new bone that's formed, completely bridges this osteotomy gap. We also did this with stem cells. So we took human mesenchymal stem cells from bone marrow, made cartilage, transplanted the cartilage from the human-derived stem cells into that gap, and we see the same thing. So it made this healed that bony defect. So we're way back here at this stage, engineering this graft. This is an engineering problem now. So biologically, this works. But how do you scale this up to go from a mouse with a 3-millimeter defect to treat a 4-inch defect in a human? It's an engineering problem. That's out of my league. This is the pathway to filing a clinical trial. So we're way back in this early stage. This is for somebody else to take through the next steps. But the strategy is to take cells, give them the signals to turn into cartilage, implant them into some scaffolding, and then take this construct and put it in that defect and see if that'll heal. So just this is the very last slide. I just want to talk to you a little bit, very briefly, about other things that we're doing. These don't really aren't amenable to nice pictures. So we're interested in variation because of disease phenotypes. Obviously, we're also the other place where you see a lot of variation is in evolution. So we're interested in studying mechanisms that drive evolutionary changes in evolutionary biology. We're very interested in the effect of age on bone healing, and specifically the interaction between age and inflammation. We think that we can block some types of inflammation that actually makes bones heal better. And then bone fractures rarely occur in isolation. They often occur in polytrauma situations. So you might injure your leg, you might have a head injury, you might have a concussive chest injury. So we're interested in working with other people at this level one trauma center to develop models of polytrauma that might more reflect
some very, very severe patients that are in very severe accidents that would come here to be treated at the hospital. So with that, I will end and turn it over to Sam. Thank you.
So the last person who will be presenting is Dr. Sam Morshed, and he's going to be speaking about the clinical research work that we do here. So while he's pulling it up, it was pulled up and then got shut off by accident. We can take a few questions. I'll stand by the mic since... Yes?
This is about education of the residents. How did they go from practicing on the cadavers and then suddenly having a person in front of them where they have to do those?
Right.
What is the transition?
Yeah, so the cadaver work typically is done once a year for each procedure. As you go through your residency, you slowly gain more and more experience. And so interns start going into the operating room. They see how things are prepped. They might scrub in. They learn how to suture. Then second-year residents will be more active, and you continually increase the amount of activity you do in the operating room during that period of time. That's how most... It's almost apprenticeship, and that's how it's been since the dawn of time. What's happening now are that there are more opportunities that are available to people to do things in a different way. So the cadaver work is supplemental. There are some places that have machines that you can practice on, and it sort of grades you. And at some point, people think that that might even be because the orthopedic surgeons have to recertify. And some people postulate that may be part of the recertification process, that you actually have to practice on a machine to show your particular skills. So what we do here is really supplemental to the apprenticeship that exists. So,
is the residency here through UCSF in a subspecialty, or is it their orthopedic?
Yeah, so after medical school, you sign up for a specialty. So that specialty could be in anything, radiology, medicine, orthopedics, and each of them have their own number of years that they have to be in school for. After you finish residency, you can do additional training in a subspecialization in that specialization. So our fellows do orthopedic trauma after their residency. So they could go out and practice if they wanted to, and they're all board eligible.
Sir? I'm wondering what kind of trauma is not orthopedic. If something just happens to miss a bone, then is it something else or what?
Well, so it's all traumatic, yeah, but it's not necessarily all orthopedic trauma. So in general, the orthopedic trauma specialists are better equipped than most orthopedic surgeons in doing complex fractures or in treating patients that have multiple injuries. Dr. Morshed will talk a little bit about some of the work that we do that involves the trauma patients and looking at trauma studies, but they're higher level injuries. If you have a bone that goes through the skin, it's called an open fracture, and you're anywhere in the city, you'll come here. It doesn't matter how full the hospital is or not. And it's those kinds of injuries that orthopedic traumatologists do instead of just doing a simple, say, fracture that an general orthopedic surgeon would be most comfortable with. So we do those too. It's just that we also do these other injuries. Now, if you injure your ligaments or your tendons, depending on what those ligaments are, like if you tear your ACL, that's more of a sports injury than it is an orthopedic trauma injury. But we have to have guys who can do that too, because it's very common to have an injury on one side and then you hurt your knee on the other side. And so that's how come we have the group rounded the way we do. So I'll turn the floor over to Dr. Morshed. I would like to just preface his talk by saying he's one of two people in North America that I'm aware of, and I'm aware of most of these folks, that are trained in not only trauma surgery, as trauma fellowship trained, but also in biostatistics and doing clinical research. So he has a PhD from Berkeley in epidemiology and biostatistics, and he did his residency here and his trauma fellowship in Seattle, which is one of the most famous trauma centers in North America, and then came here and started doing our clinical research program, which we started about 7-8 years ago, and it's really thrived, and it's extremely interesting. It's dealing with a lot of the same injuries that would make a difference in your all care if you happen to get hurt. So, Sam?
All right. Thank you, Ted. Good evening, everybody. It's nice to see some familiar faces out there. For those of you who attend, how many, just with a show of hands, how many attended the talk that I gave earlier this month? So quite a few of you guys. So you're going to see some similar themes here some similar pictures. So hopefully you haven't had dinner yet, but we'll have fun with it. We're gonna focus. Those of you guys who are there know what I'm talking about. We're gonna focus now a little bit more on that last talk was kind of what is the research that's happening in North America and globally in orthopedic trauma. Today we're gonna focus a little bit more on how that's being implemented here at our home at San Francisco General Hospital, as well as some of our affiliated centers. So the mission of our clinical research center is to perform patient-oriented research. So you've heard from Dr. Marcuzio about basic research, bench research. You'll get the chance to visit the lab in a little bit upstairs. You've heard about some education-related research in Dr. Matityahu's talk. Now we're going to talk about patient-oriented research, and that is specifically related to problems that are going on with patients in real time. So we're taking, you know, all of the great science that is built up from the development of new technologies, from new biologic agents, and we're trying to figure out what actually, when the rubber meets the road, what actually works in patients, because that is that critical final step from taking ideas from bench to bedside. We're also very much an educational organization in that we teach people how to do clinical research. So we're not only the doers of clinical research, but like you'd see if you went up to Dr. Marcuzio's lab upstairs, where he's got trainees learning how to be scientists. We do the same thing. We have trainees from the undergraduate level all the way up to people who finished an orthopedic residency and fellowship and are getting academic careers of their own launched. We lead multi-center clinical investigations, and we collaborate with centers all over the world, trying to come together to develop consensus about the most pressing issues that face us as orthopedic surgeons, specifically those who are dealing with traumatic issues, and coming together to figure out the best way to answer those questions with patient-oriented research. You've seen some of this is the why. To really tonight, I'm going to talk about the why first and foremost of what we do. We're also going to talk about what and how a little bit. But again, remember the huge, and that we really kind of, I hopefully impress this upon you, the huge burden of skeletal trauma globally and its cost to us, both globally and in our own backyard. And the real impetus for this is that there are so many wonderful technologies out there for potentially improving the way that we treat fractures, but we have not done the studies, the clinical studies, to really understand when it actually comes to a given patient, what is safe, what is efficacious. We need that final step, and that's where clinical research closes the loop. We are trying to decipher this signal, right? This is what we do in clinical research, is we do We do studies to try to find out when there is some real effect of a treatment that can be separated from all of the noise and variability in patient care, right? When I do an operation, for example, the difference, again, between surgical research, clinical research, and medical research in many ways comes down to the very nature of what surgery is. Surgery is not just one pill, right? If you were in a medical trial, you may get randomized to a placebo versus an active, you know, active treatment or an active pill, whatever that investigational drug might be. Surgery is so variable, right? Any operation that I do is thousands, tens of thousands of little micro interventions, right? And to try to figure out whether one particular technique or one particular implant or one particular drug added at a certain portion of at a certain moment in the operation makes the difference, that is difficult. And that's what I mean by separating the signal, that true effect that might be attributed to that one intervention of interest, holding everything else constant. Okay. An evidence-based practice is really what we strive for, right? This is that guiding light in clinical medicine that urges us to conscientiously use the best available evidence from clinical care research in making healthcare decisions, okay? So what are the problems? Okay, here come some of the gross pictures again, right? So if you don't remember this from last time, what kind of problems do we deal with? High energy trauma, okay? So we have two kinds of acute trauma. High energy trauma, like this this thing that looks like a foot, and low energy trauma, right? So the stuff that you think about maybe when you think about orthopedic trauma, the kind of somebody fell, broke their hip, okay? So these are the two kind of acute flavors of the clinical conditions that we treat. I also treat a lot of cold trauma, okay? So cold trauma is when trauma that was taken care of initially didn't work out right, and unfortunately, this happens a lot. As I've gotten older and my practice has developed and I get more and more referrals, this is more and more what I do every day is clean up something that didn't quite go right. Right? This is a girl who came back from Mexico after a motor vehicle accident and wasn't fixed so well, had a bad infection. So we dealt with it. So non-unions, bones that don't heal, malunions, bones that are crooked, and infections, which can kind of, you know, complicate all of these. What does that mean in terms of the kinds of research that we do here now? Okay, so we do research in looking at whether one surgery or one technique is superior to another. Okay, so that is one type of research. Another type of clinical research is looking at whether a surgery is better than no treatment at all. Right? We know these are the kinds of trials that surgeons don't often like to do because we don't want to find out that no surgery is better than surgery, but sometimes that's the case, right? Sometimes we're interested in both surgery and medication. So increasingly, the work from the basic science laboratories and have introduced families of new potential therapeutic agents that may both improve the rate of bone healing and speed it up. Okay, and so it's important for us to do the kind of research that looks at those kinds of new technologies and treatments and finds out whether they're efficacious or not. And we do a lot of research that we would call kind of research on prognosis or prognostic studies. This is kind of what you think about a little bit more when you think about epidemiologic studies. We look at kind of what's common and what's not common. What are some of the complications that we see? And then we can kind of look back and see what are some of the risk factors. Right? So this is kind of upstream a little bit in some ways to a lot of the therapeutic trials because we look at modifiable risk factors, right? That may predict a particular outcome, be it good or bad. And then we can kind of go back and think about, well, how could we potentially intervene and test a therapy or an agent or a certain type of intervention to either mitigate the risk of bad things happening or improve the rates of positive outcomes happening. Common problems, okay? Common problems are great because they tend to be low complexity. They tend to occur in larger numbers. Now, somebody might look at the SX-ray and say, well, that's not such a simple fracture to fix. But hip fractures are incredibly common, and so they have increasingly been the focus of a lot of our clinical research. Again, the numbers often lend themselves well to performing randomized trials or true experiments. One particular trial that we just finished up this last January was a study called INSIGHT. It was randomizing patients to two very commonly used implants for treatment of the most common variety of hip fracture in elder patients. And we were in that case following clinical outcomes, patient function, and quality of life. Okay, so this is a study that if you broke your hip and you showed up here, you might very well have been randomized in this trial. We also have uncommon problems, okay? And so for these rare conditions, and we're talking about kind of what's rare and what's common. I think of uncommon problems as those that typically don't show up at non-trauma centers. So they're things that come here, but they may not be conditions that are showing up at your local community hospital. They tend to be problems that are more technically demanding to take care of. There may be a limited understanding of the drivers of either treatment or outcome. Okay, and sometimes these problems, there's not an adequate feeling of equipoise, all right, on the part of surgeons, and so randomizing patients may not be ethical. Okay, and so let me tell you about another study that's currently underway here at San Francisco General Hospital. It's called the FAITH 2 trial, and it's looking at two different ways. And by the way, these are young adults with femoral neck fractures, which is an area that we are really bad at treating in general. Okay, I quote you rates generally as high as 30% complication rate in managing displaced femoral neck fractures in young patients. So this is horrible because the consequences of one of these that goes bad is often a hip replacement, which is not a thing that you want to be putting in a 20 or 30 something year old patient. Okay, so we're trying to figure out how to do better in these rare injuries, rare being, you know, that they typically, when they happen, they're high energy and they come to a trauma center. So we're randomizing patients to two different types of surgery because there's a lot of controversy about whether we ought to be fixing it with cannulated screws or a sliding hip screw. They're just technical names for a couple of those implants that you see there on the right. And we're randomizing patients to vitamin D supplementation because there's a lot of evidence that would suggest that vitamin D deficiency is a risk factor for poor healing. Okay, so we are doing a factorial randomized trial, randomizing patients to both implant and medication. Okay, limb salvage versus amputation. This is another one of these kind of rare problems, typically a problem for trauma centers that has been a question for the ages, right? What we've learned so far in a lot of good research to date has been that, you know, whether you're amputated or you're salvaged, less than 50% chance that you're going to be back working in 2 to 7 years out. We don't follow a lot of the old dogma that would suggest that because you don't have plantar sensation when you present with this injury that you would do more poorly with an amputation. So it's a lot of the research that's been done to date has really forced us to reevaluate some of what we think are the important prognostic factors for a poor outcome. We've also realized the importance of psychosocial factors that determine outcome in these patients much more so than does their treatment to begin with. So these resiliency factors that we talk about tend to be much more important in predicting outcome than the treatment, whatever it is that, you know, that somebody like me decides to do. And so these have created, obviously, a lot of opportunity for research. Over the last several decades, we've also learned from military medicine that there is a huge burden associated with major extremity trauma. And this has led people like me to actually try to work together, which is not always easy when you're getting trauma surgeons in a room together, to actually think about these problems and think about how we can work together as multi-center clinical trial study groups. Okay, putting together the power of not just one major medical center like this, but all of the major trauma centers around the country to come together, to develop questions together, and figure out ways of answering those questions in prospective clinical trials. And that's what the Metric Consortium is, which is an organization that that we are a part of, that several of us lead have taken a lead in nationally in driving the research agenda in looking at these questions around major extremity trauma. So for limb salvage versus amputation is one small area within the portfolio of a consortium like Metric. We're asking questions again about what is the burden of injury beyond which a patient would be better off with an amputation? What types of amputation techniques are superior to others? How do we best measure prosthetic fit and alignment after an amputation, and how can we optimize resiliency factors like self-efficacy and some of these other psychosocial factors? These are all clinical trials that we're doing here, and all questions we're interested in answering when our patients roll through the door. So how does it all work? Okay, so when we come up with a question, either individually or as part of a group, we have a system here, right? We don't just start doing research on patients just for the heck of it, right? There is a process to developing and building good testable hypotheses, good research questions that could be answered in a good clinical study. That study design phase is an iterative process, and it happens with a lot of us sitting around with, you know, a cup of coffee discussing good questions. What's a good question? What's a bad question? Is this a feasible study? Is it not a feasible study? And that eventually develops into a research protocol. And ultimately, we solicit funding for it. We get human subjects protection approval to conduct the study. We do the study, and ultimately, we strive to disseminate the findings of our work. So that's the process of, you know, 5 to 10 years in about, you know, 5 to 10 seconds. Every morning, how does it unfold here? Well, if you were to show up here at this conference room at 6:30 or 6:45 in the morning, you'd see us running consults. All of the new patients that were either consulted on in the emergency room or admitted to the hospital, we review their conditions, and we take a look and we say, hey, you know, of these patients who were admitted, which of these patients may be eligible for one of the clinical trials that we're running? And here's a list of several of the trials that we're running now. And, you know, these are lists that are posted around the hospital, disseminated to our residents and my fellow attendings. And we go about thinking about which ones our patients may be eligible or wanting to participate in. This happens at several of our participating centers. Currently, you know, San Francisco General and UCSF tend to be our busiest centers. San Jose Regional is increasingly coming online. We also have affiliations in Sutter and the Children's Hospital System as well. So the arms of these research projects reach out across our campuses. We've got about 12 prospective intramurally funded projects right now. We are running about 10 multi-center clinical trials. We also have some active international collaborations, which you've already heard about. Luckily, you know, some people are interested in giving us money to answer some of these questions, and so we've got a wide portfolio of funders for the various projects that we're conducting right now. Our global research projects have also been increasingly funded over the last several years. I'm not going to go into that much more. And just in conclusion, I would like just to highlight, kind of what it is that makes this work. We have a very experienced research staff. We've got a talented group of trainees that come in year in, year out, be they medical students from the medical school here or elsewhere, residents who are all conducting research projects. Many of us mentor them on those clinical projects here, as well as visiting research fellows that we get from around the world to come and spend time anywhere from 1 month to several months to even a year with us, learning how to do clinical research. We've got a mature workflow and I think a growing reputation for high quality methods and quality control in our studies. So with that, I'm going to conclude.
So let's just maybe take one or two questions, sir.
I'm just concerned, how concerned are you about some of the NIH Washington attacks that recently?
Well, I'm extremely concerned. It's, you know, when and you think about orthopedics too, musculoskeletal medicine gets about 1% of the overall NIH budget. So now we're getting, you know, 80% of 1% of the budget. It's just considering that musculoskeletal injuries are the single most common problem that we have. It's the single most common area of long-term disability, even more so than heart conditions. And it's the single most largest expenditure in the country, even more than heart conditions. And around the world, it's there are more people that die from trauma than AIDS, malaria, and TB combined. So all of these things just point to the fact that it's an important problem that's not doesn't get enough attention, and it's going to get even less attention with this. I just think it's irresponsible, but I'm not going to get into the politics of it. Any other questions?
Yes, sir. Great.
So I realize San Francisco has an unusual attitude about helicopter transport. I'm trying to understand how the Level 1 Trauma Center works without a helipad. And now that Mission Bay got one approved, do you think there's a chance, and has the new hospital been structurally designed, if you were to add one, would it hold it?
This hospital would hold a helipad. And the elevator would work. So there wouldn't be a lot of work that would need to be done on this hospital. Frankly, you know, even to go from Mission Bay to here is too long. I mean, when seconds and minutes matter, you know, driving around on Potrero with all the potholes, it's just no way to go. So it's better than nothing, but it's really not sufficient.
But do you think there's a chance to be able to get one approved?
Well, so perhaps. So this hospital was built with the idea that they weren't going to push that agenda, and they were just trying to get the hospital because they needed to. But I think there's going to be legislation in the California legislature that's going to push that forward. And also the American College of Surgeons may mandate that Level 1 Trauma Center have helipads. So stay tuned.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.